Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome back to the Welsh History Podcast, episode 211, Fight for Democracy. Responsible government is a term bandied about in places like Canada when we talk about the first time as a colony Canada gained a form of functioning democracy. This does not mean that everyone had the right to vote, or even that the majority did, but rather that at least a few had that right and they were able to vote how they wanted to. In Wales, as in the whole of the UK, the right to vote was extremely limited in previous periods. To vote for an MP, you needed to be a landholder. You obviously would need an amount of money to be able to prove that you had this ability, and you had to have so much land in order to qualify. This would obviously limit the number of people who could vote, and in Wales, in order to vote, you had to contribute eventually to the annual wage of that MP. In order to vote, all owners of a freehold property or land with an annual value of at least 40 shillings in order to vote in any county election. This requirement, known as the 40 shilling freehold, was never adjusted for inflation of land values going back to about the 15th century. So obviously, the amount of land that you needed in order to vote became much smaller as time went on, because the cost of that land would go up as time continued to progress. Much like today, if you had to get to vote for 40 shillings, we're talking a very small piece of property in order to vote, like tiny, infinitesimal. Maybe that Scottish lord plot of land would help out in that respect. Going back to a debunked idea. In order to become a member of parliament, on the other hand, you needed to win either a county or a borough seat. County members were supposed to represent landholders, while borough members were supposed to represent the mercantile and trading interests. At least that was the idea. Members of parliament who were chosen by the counties were known as Knights of the Shire. In Wales, each county elected one member, while in England, each county elected two members. Parliament boroughs in England ranged in size from small hamlets to large cities, partly because they had evolved haphazardly. The earliest boroughs were chosen in the Middle Ages by county sheriffs, and even a village might have been deemed a borough in those days. Many of these early boroughs were substantial settlements at the time of their original enfranchisement, but later went into decline, and by the early 19th century, only a few of these maybe were populated by a small portion of people, but yet held two MPs because that was how it was developed, and that was how it was organized. And thus these boroughs became known or nicknamed rotten boroughs because very few electors were there to actually vote for these MPs. These boroughs had either as few eligible voters as 100, and in some cases as few as 7. So you could easily put people in those places that would win, because all you had to do was own the property in that area, and it only had to be worth 40 shillings. So a wealthy patron could easily throw around a bit of money, and suddenly he had property in all of these areas, which he could either give to someone else or hold on his own. Not only that, but you could vote in multiple constituencies. You were not restricted to your local constituency, and where you lived was just down to what land you owned. So if you owned land in Lincoln and land in Wrexham, you could vote in both as long as you could get there. The key to all that is of course, unlike today where polling times are held at the same time, polling in this era was over days. And so if a poll in Wrexham was on the 28th, but the poll in Lincoln was on the 30th, you could easily make both of them and vote in both polls, and it would be completely fair and legal. That's a little different from what we're dealing with nowadays. In order to run for Parliament, you had to prove that you had an annual income of £600 if you were a county candidate, and borough candidates needed about £300, which by default means you needed to be wealthy to even run. And of course, elite families could then fudge that annual income to their own benefit, because of course, they would often make themselves the kingmaker of these seats and would control the area by dishing the seats out to different people within the family. This was actually particularly the case in South Wales, where ancient families, in other words, families that had been around for centuries, controlled a lot of the wealth in the area and thus controlled a lot of the MPs. Another unique portion of the Welsh voting experience was an idea that not only did you have to be a respectable, wealthy citizen, but it's also useful if you could link your ancestry to ancient Welsh nobility, so you could appeal to as many people from as many angles as possible. This sometimes meant that if an Englishman who come to this area for some reason or other, be it marriage into the local wealthy family, or were working for said family and were suddenly treated as if they were, you know, someone worth having in this position, then they would do whatever they needed to do in order to claim that that person actually had ancestry either to the Welsh nobility or some other random Celtic origin, such as Cornish. And it may not even be close to accurate, but it worked in their favor. So then you could claim these lineages, and thus it became kind of trendy to do that in Wales, which obviously that would be important. Because there was so much about Welsh voting that was controlled by the nobility and gentry in Wales, there was this appeal to remain conservative in their values and firm on those ideals that met these beliefs. Welsh radicals were not typically gaining votes with these men. Electoral reform was considered very much an unwelcome addition to the political discussion, something that was coming up increasingly thanks to the revolutions in America and France. In Wales, unlike England, where this drove a lot of response and a lot of reaction and a demand for more fairness and more equality, in Wales it took a lot longer for the old guard to feel like they were in trouble and actually have to act on things. Because largely this didn't really hit Wales until later. It wasn't until you have industrial cities in Wales being influenced by various writers and thinkers that were coming out of other places. Of course, a key for an MP is to act as both the voice of the community as well as the voice of those who are financing, shall we say, his run as MP. Thus, not only would they be representative of the community in the Parliament, but they would also be a key component of developing positions for wealthy families to send, you know, son number 3 into, say, the government bureaucracy or into other popular spots in London in order to get jobs and to build wealth. This, of course, is not surprising. It was something that's happened before this. It happened after this. And one can argue still probably happens to a degree today, where knowing somebody was just as important as knowing things that would actually help you get the job. So realistically, this wasn't like a silver bullet. You couldn't immediately gain access to the upper echelons of London society if just because an MP from, you know, Carmarthen showed up. That likely wasn't going to be a big money winner, and it didn't necessarily get you anywhere, but it gave you an opportunity to possibly get somewhere, especially if that MP became more connected and more well-known, voted the right way, da-da-da-da-da. All of those things are important. Just as important during the Regency period and after was to be seen as an important member of society. Attending balls, cultural events, and dinners were important for candidates to appeal to their voters. Remember, all voters are wealthy, landholders. And so they were expected to contribute also to those landholders' various causes. If they were running a charitable company, they were running a society, if they were running events that were culturally significant or not, they would help to fund those either through their own money or through gaining government grants. In modern parlance, all of those things would be important to gaining attention, gaining notoriety, and gaining a sense of respect from the local community. You could be a rank outsider, but if you did all the things to sort of represent yourself as being an upstanding member of the community, you would definitely gain more control and better relationships with the people who mattered, in quotes. This, however, started to change, and this came about, in some cases, out of the rapid industrialization that was happening in both the North and Southeast. For this created a situation where the older families would have less influence with those who now controlled the industrial centers, and therefore the new voices were not necessarily radically different in their conservative viewpoint, but they were definitely less rural focused and had less drive to help the rural areas out. So if they could drive more voters in the area that voted their way, they could win these kind of elections. For example, Benjamin Hall, a wealthy industrialist, defeated a member of the wealthy and noble Morgan family from Glamorgan. Matching this new movement of different players coincided with a new call for reform, which had started in the previous century but continued to grow in the early 19th century as more and more people were wanting to have a voice in government, and a lot of appeals to a lot of different things came about in this particular decade that we're talking about, which is the 1820s, including anti-slavery, more and better protection for the poor, better protection and more protection for the worker, a protection of children. All of these things, along with electoral reform, were coming to a head almost at the exact same time and driving forward a lot of the agenda that will come over the 1830s. And this is why I've been building to this in various things ever since we've started these episodes recently, is because much of what is going to push forward a new agenda for Wales and develop a great big change in the way Wales itself views itself comes out of these developments between the industrialization and then the reaction to it. And then following that, the desire for people who had been either underrepresented or not represented to actually have a voice within society all of a sudden becomes way more important and way more critical for all sides. And it's a discussion that will blow up in this decade coming. In Wales in the 1700s, for example, there was appealing for steps of reform, but most of their focus was built on adding more MPs than more voting rights. Obviously, with the English having two MPs per borough as opposed to Wales's one, that was an unfair advantage they had, and that was something Wales wanted to put a stop to. So there was a movement towards that idea, but there was little desire or movement toward the expansion of the franchise, as it was mostly in its infancy in Wales. This would change as industrialization, as I just said, came about, and more people became literate and involved in the political discourse. This, of course, started to drive discussions for those who had no voice. We mentioned how radicalism from England started to enter Wales discourse a couple of episodes ago. Speeches by men such as Orator Hunt began to be translated into Welsh and were then read by the population. By 1817, the voices of radicals were making inroads, but the reality is you couldn't call it a major reform movement at that stage in Wales, at least. However, by 1821, first reform meetings were being held in Breconshire. A local Whig member, Walter Williams, hosted the first one in January of that year, and radical MPs presented petitions from across Wales to the Parliament calling on reforms. These MPs typically didn't come from Wales, but they had gone around with petitions and polls to try and influence the government. When King George IV was crowned in 1821, there was an increasing movement within various sectors of political thought in Britain to extend the voting franchise to groups that still did not have a voice, such as landless people, urban poor, women, and Catholics, who were still largely kept out of parliamentary activity. While there were some support amongst the MPs, generally the House of Lords continued to fight against any reform when they could. Calls for equal representation continued to grow, including an 1819 protest in Birmingham of 20,000 people, which had called for, in quotes, equal representation or death, end quote. Reformers were on the march, but in Wales, this was much slower, as I said, and most of the calls for reform in Wales in the 1820s revolved not around the franchise, but around agricultural and financial reforms. At the heart of the Welsh movement was social concerns, and they were growing in strength as the rural areas were struggling under the weight of industrialization in other parts of the country. If you're like me and eating healthy is a bit of a problem, let me bend your ear a little bit to eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggies. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. Also, if you're looking for gourmet meals, try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/WelshHistoryPod50 and use the code WelshHistoryPod50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code WelshHistoryPod50 at factormeals.com/WelshHistoryPod50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.
During most of the 1820s, Wales had not really grown very reform-minded, as I mentioned, before the break. To their English counterparts, this was really not something they wanted, and they wanted to push more people in the country to actually be active. Labor issues, of course, were very much front and center, and most of the violence, protests, and debates filtered around those issues, which, of course, were very important to the Welsh population. They did not have as much to do with the current conflict over voting rights and equality of voting effort, probably because they didn't necessarily see that as a possibility at this point. However, reform bills started to pick up popularity around 1829, when the first bill was introduced, called the Catholic Relief Act, which repealed various laws that created separation and impairments against the Irish Catholics to avoid them having a say in the political process. The Tories of the day were led by Duke of Wellington, who was Prime Minister, and he was key to drawing up the act that would hopefully put a stop to, or at least avoid, more Irish protests. He was not some reformer, but rather just simply trying to avoid open conflict within his own party, where some of his colleagues were actively calling for reform. And of course, the Whigs, the other side, were slowly coming around to the idea of supporting reform as a party tenet, something which had not been the case previously, as it was mostly a radical Whig section of the party that had been pushing this idea. After the 1830 election, which the Tories won, but the parties remained divided, support for the Prime Minister, the Duke of Wellington, was weak. This allowed other forces to start to influence the political discussion and poke holes in the divisions between the various Tory factions. When the opposition raised the issue of reform in one of the first debates of the year, the Duke made a controversial defense of the existing system of government that was recorded in the formal third-party language of the time, so that when the Duke says he, for example, it's simply a reference to himself. Similar to, I guess, what the Queen would have done back then as well, which we all think of. To quote the Duke, he was fully convinced that the country possessed, at present moment, a legislature which answered all the good purposes of the legislation, and this to a greater degree than any other legislature had ever answered in any country whatever. He would go further and say that the legislature and system represented possessed the full and entire confidence of the country. He would go further still and say that if at present moment he had imposed upon him the duty of forming a legislature for any country, he did not mean to assert that he could form such a legislature as they possessed now, for the nature of man is incapable of reaching such excellence at once. As long as he held any station in government in the country, he should always feel it was his duty to resist reform measures when proposed by others, end quote. His attitude was so bad that it led to a revolt against his ideas, and less than 2 weeks after Wellington made these remarks, on the 15th of November, 1830, he was forced to resign after he was defeated in a motion of no confidence. The Whig reformer, Earl Charles Grey, was appointed the new Prime Minister, and with the new reformists heading the government, movement towards democratic change was on the table. First, with a bill on March 1st of 1831, which wanted to bring an end to the rotten borough system. However, it did not pass, as the government was defeated on an amendment of the bill so that an election had to be called. This time, the election was specifically fought only on the reforming of the electoral system. This would be a very tight election in Wales. 9 reformers would win outright, while 8 anti-reformers won as well. The final 2 seats, one of which we're about to talk about, were decided when the anti-reformists stepped down rather than face an electorate who was very unhappy with them. One of these seats in Carmarthen was held by John Jones from the so-called Red Faction, a local Tory faction, and had held the seat since 1821. At the time, he was considered a bit of a local hero for this accomplishment and was opposed by the Blue Faction, better known as the Whigs. However, the focus of this election surrounded the town of Carmarthen, which he was the MP for. The borough, prior to the election, held a reform meeting on February 22, 1831. At the meeting, George Thomas proposed a moderate reform petition, and the radicals, led by Hugh Williams, who were also in this meeting, succeeded in amending it to include demands for the ballot and restoration of the triennial parliaments. It was received by the House on the 28th of February, and on presenting it and in an open letter that day, longtime MP Jones, who had been unable to attend the meeting, he announced that he did not agree with the petitioner's demands for short parliaments, universal suffrage, or any proposal involving the disenfranchisement of existing voters, referring specifically in these rotten boroughs. Yet he still said that he was a friend towards reform and franchise transfers from decaying boroughs to populous towns should probably be done, which was really the bare minimum of reforms and did little to stop his radical opponents. As the Prime Minister stood up to oppose these reforms, Jones also voted against the reforms and against the Act. The radicals in Carmarthen County led a condemnation of Jones and all the things in which he stood for. Jones thought that notwithstanding his majority vote for the Gascoigne Amendment, in other words, the bringing down of the Whigs Act on April 19th of 1831, that he had moved far enough on reform issues to satisfy his constituents. So therefore, he didn't really anticipate any opposition in Carmarthen at the ensuing general election, which happened because of this vote of unconfidence. His opponents, John George Phillips, made sure voters knew of Jones's votes for Wellington and his attitude against the bill, alluded frequently to Phillips' lineage. As a local candidate, he was, of course, descended from great stock, but also, importantly, he was an uncompromising reformer and a supporter of retrenchment and the abolition of colonial slavery. On April 29th, voters met with Jones at the polls. This was on polling day. These voters were very much unwilling to put up with the Tory MP, and then, because of that, punches were then thrown. It was said that Jones was injured during the fighting, and fearing that there would be more conflict, the magistrates postponed the election for a day and kicked everyone out of the city town office. A call went out for 140 magistrates to come and help keep order, but few actually took up this call, likely fearing for their own safety in a hostile environment. Jones would be defeated on a show of hands in the town hall, as the electors basically decided that he should step down. But tensions were still very high. Even after the vote took place, the fears of local authorities of further rioting and violence led to a demand for military intervention. In the August election, constables, for example, were assaulted during the polling day, as reform unrest was being assisted by continued social unrest. The consequences of these various pieces of legislation, from the Poor Act to the Election Reformation Acts, had not gone far enough in settling issues, and public distrust and dislike of the current system was slowly growing and about to explode in Wales. As I mentioned earlier, during the 1830s, there will be a great deal of discussion about this and about what it leads to and how important it is for what Wales is to become. However, with that, I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can always reach me at the Welsh History Podcast at gmail.com. If you would like, you can also reach out to me on Twitter at Welsh History Pod, or you can reach out to us and join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Welsh History Podcast. And if you'd like to help this program continue, you can do so via Patreon. That helps me to purchase the research materials that help give this podcast as much possibility of being able to cover these issues as much as I can. And thank you all once again for any contributions, and thank you all for listening. I hope you have a great day. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Welsh History Podcast is a member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To find more information on them, you can do so at evergreenpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
Hello. This is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.